The Evolution of Evolvability. The year after The Blind Watchmaker was published, I was invited by Christopher Langton, visionary inventor of the science of artificial life, to the inaugural conference of his new discipline at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. It was sobering to see where the original atomic bomb was developed and recall in the midst of the long piece the dark oracular words of Robert Oppenheimer after the first atom bomb test in the desert. We knew the world would not be the same. Few people laughed, few people cried. Most people were silent. I remember the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another. The people who gathered for the first artificial life conference were very different from Oppenheimer's colleagues, but I could imagine that the atmosphere was a little bit similar. Pioneers coming together to work on a completely new and strange enterprise, albeit ours was constructive and theirs as destructive as can readily be imagined. In addition to Chris Langton himself, I was pleased to meet various luminaries of the nearby Santa Fe Institute, including Stuart Kaufman, Doan Farmer, and Norman Packard. The latter two had been comrades in arms in an adventurous, indeed perilous, attempt to break the bank at Las Vegas using principles of Newtonian physics, with miniature computers concealed in their shoes and operated by their toes. The whole story is entertainingly told by Thomas Bass in yet another of those books whose title I decline to mention because it was gratuitously changed as it crossed the Atlantic. Something of the same risky spirit, together with the dreamlike atmosphere of the New Mexico desert, seemed to be embodied in a charming young woman whom I also met at the conference, and who drove me to her home in the desert, outside Santa Fe. She tried to persuade me to take ecstasy. I hadn't heard of it before, this was 1987, and I now think I was right to decline her offer, although it felt cowardly at the time. But something about her soft beauty, her strange adobe house, the New Age music she played for me, the ghostly silence of the desert, and the crisp clarity of the air which, as in a dream, shrank the distance to the mountains, gave me a high with no need for the drug. Somehow that little interlude in her company, especially the 100-mile view of the mountains, almost psychedelically magnified on the southwest horizon, sums up for me the atmosphere at that remarkable conference. I entitled my talk, "The Evolution of Evolvability," and so far as I'm aware, my lecture, followed by my paper in the published proceedings of the conference, represents the debut of that now much-used phrase. I used a Mac to demonstrate the extra freedom to evolve in the expanded biomorph space granted by the increase from 9 to 16 genes, and I then went on to expound the biological moral. It's too easy for an arch-adaptationist like me to think that natural selection can achieve anything without limit. But selection can work only on the mutations that embryology throws up. This was one of the constraints on perfection that I had listed in The Extended Phenotype 5 years earlier. Evolutionary change is a crawl through the multidimensional corridors of the museum of all possible animals. But some of the corridors, if not totally blocked, are harder to negotiate than others, and evolution, like water trickling down a hill, will seek the path of least resistance. The point about the evolution of evolvability is this. Maybe some previously blocked or quantitatively impeded corridors in the museum can be suddenly unblocked by the evolutionary invention of an innovation in embryology. The first segmented individual back in Precambrian antiquity may or may not have been better at surviving than its unsegmented parents, but the embryological revolution that birthed it triggered a new burst of evolution, as if floodgates had been suddenly opened. Could there then be a kind of higher-level natural selection, choosing whole lineages by virtue of the evolutionary fertility of their embryologies? To me, as a committed Darwinian adaptationist back in the 1980s, this was verging on a heretical idea, but it was one that excited me. The first segmented animal must have had unsegmented parents, and it must have had at least two segments. The essence of segments is that they are like one another in complex respects. A centipede is a train with a long series of identical leg-bearing trucks in the middle, a sensory engine at the front, and a genital caboose at the back. The segments of the human spine are not identical, but all have the same pattern of a vertebra, dorsal and ventral nerves, muscle blocks, repeated blood vessels, and so on. Snakes have hundreds of vertebrae, and some species have hugely more vertebrae than others, most of them identical to their neighbours in the train. Since all snake species are cousins of one another, individual snakes must from time to time be born with more or fewer vertebrae than their parents, and always a whole number more or fewer. You can't have half a segment. You can go from 150 segments to 151 or to 155, but not to 150.5 or 149.5 segments. Segments are all or none. We now understand pretty well how this comes about by what are called homeotic mutations. Amazingly, a stunning discovery that long postdates my undergraduate days reading zoology, it is the same homeotic mutations that mediate segmentation in both vertebrates and arthropods, and genes can even be transplanted from mice to fruit flies and have something tantalizingly like the same effect. The year before my Evolution of Evolvability lecture, in The Blind Watchmaker, I had written of stretched DC8 as opposed to Boeing 747 macromutations. The distinguished astronomer Sir Fred Hoyle, not the first or the last physicist to blunder ineptly into biology, expressed his scepticism of Darwinism with the image of a hurricane blowing through a junkyard and having the luck to assemble a Boeing 747. He was talking about the origin of life, abiogenesis, but his metaphor has become a favourite with creationists casting doubt on evolution itself. The point they miss, of course, is the power of cumulative natural selection, the slow climb up the gentle slopes of Mount Improbable. There's a photo of me in the E appendix, standing in an aircraft graveyard, keeping a weather eye out for hurricanes that might spontaneously put together a Boeing 747. I invoked another airliner, the Stretch DC-8, in a contrasting metaphor. This was a version of the DC-8 airliner lengthened 11 metres by the insertion of two extra plug-ins, 6 extra metres in the forward fuselage and 5 metres in the aft fuselage. It was a DC-8 with two homeotic mutations. We can think of each row of seats in the additional portions of the fuselage with its associated tray tables, lights, ventilators, call buttons, music ports, etc., as a segment, a duplicate of the pre-mutation segments. My biological point was that while there is a fundamental objection to a radically new complex animal or complex organ being produced in a single mutational leap, Hoyle 747, there is no principled objection to the duplication of whole segments, no matter how complex each segment might be, my DC-8. You can't invent a vertebra from scratch, but you can make a second vertebra, given that a first already exists, in a single mutation. The embryological machinery that can make one segment can make two segments, or 10, and we now even know about the homeotic mechanism that does it. Embryological mechanisms can also easily stretch every one of a series of segments. I'd still call the result a stretch DC-8, even though that isn't the way the airliner mutated. This is because it's not a major jump in complexity, as a hypothetical 747 mutation would be. A giraffe has the same number of neck vertebrae as any ordinary mammal, 7. The giraffe's neck achieves its great length by stretching all 7 cervical vertebrae. I strongly suspect that it happened gradually, but there would be no objection of the principled, insuperable 747 type to the proposition that the neck shot out in a single macromutation, affecting all 7 vertebrae simultaneously. The existing embryological machinery to make neck vertebrae, with all their associated complexity of nerves, blood vessels and muscles, was all present and correct. All that was needed was a quantitative tweak in some growth field to stretch all 7 simultaneously and massively. And the same would have been true if, as in snakes, the elongation had been achieved by duplicating the vertebrae rather than by stretching each one. The authoritarian regime in George Orwell's 1984 prescribed a daily 2 minutes hate against a renegade party member called Goldstein, shades of Trotsky or the fallen angel myth of Satan. Substitute scorn for hate, and you have some idea of the prevailing reaction in the Oxford Zoology Department of my undergraduate days to the German-American geneticist Richard Goldschmidt, largely under the influence of E.B. Ford. Goldschmidt's hopeful monster idea of the evolutionary importance of macro mutations is indeed misguided in the context in which he proposed it, for example, in the very Oxford bailiwick of butterfly mimicry. But since he never strayed from conscionable stretched DC-8 territory towards Boeing 747 macromutational fantasy, Goldschmidt was not in principle beyond the pale. And it would be hard to fault the title Hopeful Monster for the first segmented animal, not that anybody has ever seen a fossil of that long-dead Model T of morphological mass production. Macromutations, mutations of large effect, do occur. There is no principled objection to a macromutation being incorporated into a gene pool as the norm, although it seldom happens. My principled objection is to the idea of a macromutation putting together a brand new complex functioning organ or system with many parts whose simultaneous combination would be too much of a coincidence, something like an eye with its retina, lens, focusing muscles, aperture controlling machinery, and so on. There is no principled objection to the idea that the four-eyed fish, Anableps, could have acquired its two extra eyes in a single macromutation. Indeed, that is probably how it did happen, a lovely example of stretched DC-8 evolution by homeotic mutation. The embryonic machinery of the pre-mutated ancestor already knew how to make an eye, but any one of those eyes, or indeed any vertebrate, could not have been made from scratch in a single mutational step. Such 747 evolution would be inadmissibly miraculous. The machinery of a vertebrate had originally to be built up gradually, step by step. Hereabouts, by the way, lies the answer to the silly claim originating with Stephen Gould and often reiterated that Darwin, as a gradualist, would have been opposed to so-called punctuated evolution. Darwin was a gradualist only in the sense that he would have had no truck with 747 macromutations. Although Darwin obviously didn't use airliner terminology, the nature of his objections was such as to preclude only macromutations of the 747 kind, not the stretched DC-8 variety. The evolution of language could be an interesting test case for discussion. Could the ability to speak have arisen in a single macromutation? As I've already mentioned, the main qualitative feature that separates human language from all other animal communication is syntax, hierarchical embedment of relative clauses, prepositional clauses, etc. The software trick that makes this possible, at least in computer languages, and presumably in human language too, is the recursive subroutine. A subroutine is a piece of code that, when called, remembers whence it was called and returns there when it is finished. A recursive subroutine has the additional ability to call itself and then return to an outer, more global version of itself. I went into this in detail in An Appetite for Wonder, so will here content myself with the following example. The adjective noun of the adjective noun which adverbly adverbly verbed in noun of the noun which verbed adverbly verbed. The sentence was composed by a computer program that I wrote capable of generating an infinite number of perfectly grammatical, if lacking in semantic content, sentences recognizable as syntactically correct by any native speaker of English. Notice how the subsidiary clauses embed themselves within the main sentence rather than being tacked on at the end. It takes almost no effort to write a program capable of generating any number of grammatically correct, though semantically empty, sentences of this kind. But only if your computer language allows recursive subroutines. It could not, for example, have been written in the original IBM Fortran language or any of its contemporary rivals. I wrote it in the only slightly younger language, Algol 60, and it could easily be written in any of the more modern programming languages developed after the macro mutation of recursive subroutines was introduced. It looks as though the human brain must possess something equivalent to recursive subroutines, and it's not totally implausible that such a faculty might have come about in a single mutation, which we should probably call a macromutation. There's even some suggestive evidence that a particular gene called FOXP2 might be involved, since those rare individuals with a mutated version of this gene can't talk properly. More tellingly, this is one of the minority of regions of the genome where humans are unique among the great apes. However, the evidence on FOXP2 is unclear and controversial, and I won't discuss it further. The reason I'm prepared to contemplate macromutation in this case is a logical one. Just as you can't have half a segment, there are no intermediates between a recursive and a non-recursive subroutine. Computer languages either allow recursion or they don't. There's no such thing as half recursion. It's an all-or-nothing software trick. And once that trick has been implemented, hierarchically embedded syntax immediately becomes possible and capable of generating indefinitely extended sentences. The macro mutation seems complex and 747-ish, but it really isn't. It's a simple addition, a stretch DC8 mutation, to the software, which abruptly generates huge runaway complexity as an emergent property. Emergent. Important word, that. If a mutant human was born, suddenly capable of true hierarchical syntax, you might well ask who she could talk to. Wouldn't she have been awfully lonely? If the hypothetical recursion gene was dominant, this would mean that our first mutant individual would express it, and so would 50% of her offspring. Was there a first linguistic family? Is it significant that FOXP2 actually does happen to be a genetic dominant? On the other hand, it's hard to imagine how, even if a parent and half her children did share the software apparatus for syntax, they could immediately start using it to communicate. I'll briefly mention again the possibility, which I discussed in An Appetite for Wonder, that this recursive software might have been used for some pre-linguistic function, such as planning a hunt for an antelope or a battle against a neighbouring tribe. Each phase of a cheetah's hunt has a series of appetitive routines, calling subordinate routines, each one terminated by a stopping rule, which signals a return to the point in the superior program from which the subroutine was called. Could this subroutine-based software have paved the way for linguistic syntax, just waiting for the last macro mutation to fall into place, the mutation that allowed a subroutine to call itself recursion? Noam Chomsky is the genius mainly responsible for our understanding of hierarchically nested grammar, as well as other linguistic principles. He believes that human children, unlike the young of any other species, are born with a genetically implanted language learning apparatus in the brain. The child learns the particular language of her tribe or nation, of course, but it is easy for her to do so because she's simply fleshing out what her brain already knows about language, using her inherited language machine. Hereditarian tendencies in intellectuals, nowadays, though not always in the past, tend to be associated with the political right, and Chomsky, to put it mildly, hails from the opposite pole of the political spectrum. This disjunct has sometimes struck observers as paradoxical. But Chomsky's hereditarian position in this one instance makes sense, and more to the point, interesting sense. The origin of language may represent a rare example of the hopeful monster theory of evolution. Less dramatic than hopeful monsters such as might have initiated segmentation or, arguably, language, there could have been lots of embryological innovations which, while not conferring dramatic survival advantages on their first individual possessors, opened floodgates to future evolution. And so we return to the evolution of evolvability. In coining this phrase at the Los Alamos conference, I meant to include a kind of higher-order natural selection, which we notice with hindsight. A new innovation, whether or not it directly improves the survival of the individual in the short term, leads to multiple evolutionary branchings such that its descendants inherit the earth. Segmentation was my primary example, and language might be an especially dramatic one, but there are others. The early adaptations that enabled fish to leave the water and invade the land didn't just help those pioneers to a new source of food or a new way to escape marine predators. They pioneered new living environments, not just for individual survival in the short term, but for clades blossoming through future ages. Just as Darwinian selection favours adaptations that help individuals to survive, so there can be a higher-order non-Darwinian selection, or Darwinian only in a vague and arguably confusing sense, among lineages for the quality of evolvability. Such was the point I made in my Evolution of Evolvability lecture at the Los Alamos conference, and I illustrated it with my computer biomorphs and the new vistas of evolution that were opened up to them when I rewrote the program with new genes for segmentation and symmetry in various planes. In the question session after my lecture, sympathetically chaired by the distinguished theoretical biologist Stuart Kaufman, somebody jokingly asked whether my biomorph program, in addition to breeding an alphabet, could breed money. In a flash, I was able to bring up on the screen a passable dollar sign. And thus my talk came to its end in good-humoured laughter. Kaleidoscopic embryos. Although my Los Alamos talk was called The Evolution of Evolvability, I didn't at that stage carry the theme as far as I might have. The chapter of Climbing Mount Improbable called Kaleidoscopic Embryos went further and in a direction that I find rather satisfying. I've already mentioned the mirror genes that I introduced in one of the later versions of my biomorph program. The genes that control animal symmetry in various planes can also be thought of as inserting mirrors in the embryo, like the mirrors in a kaleidoscope. Most, but not all, animals have this kind of mirror running down the midline, which makes them symmetrical in the left-right direction. A mutation in the third leg of an insect might theoretically affect the right side only, but actually it is mirrored on the left side too. Technically, this mirroring is a constraint, for it restricts freedom to evolve. Without it, perfect symmetry could still be achieved, contrived might be more apt, by separate mutations on the two sides, along with a whole lot of exotic asymmetries. But if we assume, as is plausible for reasons I discussed in Climbing Mount Improbable, that there is some more global benefit to left-right symmetry itself, evolutionary improvement is speeded up if mutations are automatically mirrored on both sides. Therefore, rather than being seen as a constraint, which it strictly is, the imposition of symmetry, a midline mirror in the embryonic kaleidoscope, can be seen as the opposite, as an evolutionary advance in evolvability. The same is true of other planes of symmetry, although these are less common in real biology. The E appendix shows three examples. First is a computer biomorph with four-way symmetry, two kaleidoscopic mirrors at right angles. Second is the skeleton of a radiolarian, an exquisite microscopic single-celled creature. And third, a stalked jellyfish, obviously not to the same scale. All of them have two mirrors at right angles, buried deep in their embryology. In the case of the biomorph, I know this is true because I wrote the embryology software. In the case of the two real animals, I don't know for sure, but I would bet my shirt that the four-way symmetry is a default constraint in the embryology. My conjecture is that whatever was the innovation in the fundamental embryology that set up this kaleidoscopic constraint, it had an advantage, and I would want to call that innovation an evolutionary advance in evolvability. Echinoderms, starfish, sea urchins, brittle stars, etc., mostly have five-way symmetry. Once again, it seems to me almost obvious that the relevant symmetry rule is lodged deep within the embryology, such that a mutation in a detail at the tip of one arm of a starfish, say, is mirrored in all five arms. This generalisation is not negated by the fact that occasionally starfish with more than five arms turn up. And once again, given that the symmetry is for some reason a good thing for a starfish to have, mirroring the mutations is a shortcut, when compared with piecemeal change in each arm separately, to achieving change without departing from five-way symmetry. It therefore deserves to be considered under the heading of evolution of evolvability. And it is significant that all my efforts to breed five-way symmetrical biomorphs on the computer screen failed. It's almost obvious. Five-way symmetry could be achieved only by a radical rewrite of the embryology routine, which again makes the point that we really are talking about the evolution of evolvability. The echinoderm biomorphs that I managed to breed on the screen and are in the E appendix are all cheats. They look superficially like a sand dollar, a sea lily, a sea urchin, a brittle star, and two starfish respectively, but not one of them is five-way symmetrical. At the time of the Los Alamos conference, there were no colour macs. When I finally got one, the obvious next step in expanding the genome of my biomorphs was to add a new suite of genes for colour. At the same time, I added genes to modify the lines with which the basic trees of the embryology algorithm were drawn. Simple lines were still allowed, but I introduced a new gene to change their thickness, and other new genes to change them from simple lines to rectangles or ovals, to control whether these shapes were filled or open, and to control the colour of the lines and of the fill. These extra genes opened up new floodgates of evolution, tempting the selecting human to breed biomorphs that looked more and more like exotic flower designs, table mats and butterflies. I had a fancy to take the computer out into the garden and offer real bees and butterflies the chance to choose the flowers and butterflies on the screen. I hoped that real insects would breed simulacra of real species of flowers, starting from non-flower-like beginnings. Unfortunately, it turned out, as I should have anticipated, that the bright daylight that brings the insects out to forage is the very same bright daylight that makes the screen difficult to see. As so often happens with seemingly bright ideas, I shelved the project and never came back to it. Perhaps night-flying moths? Would a modified version of a touch-sensitive screen like an iPad's respond directly to the buffeting of a moth? I was creating colour biomorphs at about the time I met Lala. Embroidery is one of her many talents. At that time she hadn't moved on to mosaics, painting ceramics, or her current art forms, weaving and drawing with a sewing machine. And she was inspired by the coloured four-way symmetrical biomorphs to embroider cushions and chair covers, in which the stitches of the embroidery corresponded exactly to pixels on the computer screen. See the e-appendix. They are still much admired 20 years later. All my biomorph-style programs employed artificial selection, not natural selection. I could only dream about the much more difficult problem of how to simulate natural selection in an interesting way. The fact that it's difficult is itself instructive. One could imagine building into my biomorph program a selection criterion such as spikiness or roundness. And indeed I did exactly that as an experiment. This bypassed the human eye as selection agent, and it did work, but it wasn't biologically very interesting. In order to simulate survival in a world, it would be necessary to construct that world with its own physics, its own ideally three-dimensional geography, its own rules for how biomorphs should interact with other objects and other biomorphs in that world, rules for how not to occupy the same physical space as other objects, and so on. In the years since The Blind Watchmaker was published, clever programmers have developed such artificial worlds with their own physics. For example, Steve Grand with his creatures, Torsten Ryle with his natural motion, and the various fantasy environments of the Second Life type. Out of my league, and anyway, I've shaken off the addiction to programming. Arthromorphs. The evolution of evolvability is all about floodgates opening to new creative improvement. The Los Alamos conference, where I introduced the idea, became a kind of metaphor for the idea itself, because that conference really did release something a bit like a creative surge in my own mind, and probably in other participants' minds as well. For me, that surge was to reach its climax in Climbing Mount Improbable, which I regard as my most underrated book. It is the least read of them all, although it is probably the most innovative after The Extended Phenotype. And now here's another gate that the conference opened. It was there that I met Ted Kaler, one of Apple's star programmers. Ted has the sort of creatively original mind we have come to associate with that artistically innovative corporation. He was there partly to assist with computer demonstrations, including mine, but his expertise and interests extend way beyond such technicalities, and I had many discussions with him on evolutionary ideas. I saw more of him later when he was working with Alan Kay's Apple-sponsored education project in Los Angeles, the project whose high-pressure think tank I was briefly privileged to join when I stayed with the lovely Gwen Roberts and did most of my work on the colour biomorphs. Ted and I brainstormed with increasing enthusiasm. It's a wonderful feeling, as I described in the WASP chapters, when joint thinking goes fast and well. We obsessed about the evolution of evolvability, especially segmentation, and together we hatched a plan to write a new biomorph-style artificial selection program concentrating on segmented, arthropod-like artificial creatures and incorporating other overtly biological principles of embryology. We called our new artificial creatures arthromorphs. The original Blind Watchmaker biomorphs had 9 genes. The Los Alamos version had 16. The colour version had 36. Each enlargement of the genome opened what I have been calling floodgates, unleashing an expansion of evolutionary creativity, albeit constrained in constructive ways, for example by segmentation or kaleidoscopic mirrors. But each of these enhancements relied on a major intervention by the programmer. I had to go back to the drawing board and write a whole lot of new code. And in a way, that is a suitable metaphor for the evolution of evolvability, for I do think that in real biology, the radical watershed events we are talking about, like the origin of segmentation, the origin of multicellularity, the origin of sex, or the origin of five-way symmetry in echinoderms, are rare and rather catastrophic upheavals, a little bit analogous to a major rewrite of a computer program. Indeed, the analogy even extends to debugging, for we can be sure that when a revolutionary mutation is incorporated into the gene pool by selection, it will have knock-on effects, which need to be ironed out in its wake, ironed out by subsequent selection in favour of a retinue of minor mutations that smooth away the adverse side effects of a generally beneficial major mutation. But real biology knows an intermediate tier of mutation, less revolutionary than the origin of multicellularity, sex, segmentation, or novel mirrors of symmetry, but more radical than the ordinary point mutations whereby a Watson-Crick nucleotide changes to another of the gang of four, C, T, G, or A. This intermediate category includes duplications, or the inverse, deletions, of whole stretches of chromosome. Gene duplication is the main way in which genomes get bigger. In the ancestor's tale, specifically in the lamprey's tale, I describe the process for the particular case of hemoglobin. To recap briefly, we have five different globin chains coded by different genes in different parts of the genome. And the point is that all five are descended from a single ancestral globin coded by a single ancestral gene. The ancestral gene, which is still the only one possessed by our remote and primitive cousins, the lampreys, was successively duplicated in evolution to make the multiple globin genes we have today. Normally, when we speak of evolutionary divergence, we mean the splitting of an ancestral species into two populations of walking, breathing animals split and go their separate ways. Here, on the other hand, while we are still talking about evolutionary divergences, we are talking about splits that each occurred within a single individual, so that the two descendant molecular lineages persisted side by side within the bodies of future individuals through all future generations. Incidentally, I'm often asked whether our improved understanding of genomics has changed what I would say if I were to rewrite the selfish gene. The answer is no, a reluctant no in some ways, for scientists take pride in changing their minds when new evidence comes in. My gene's eye view of 1976 is, if anything, strengthened by new considerations, such as the gene duplication discussed in the lamprey's tale. This is because we now see evolutionary divergence at the gene level within individuals, which downplays the importance of the individual, as opposed to the gene, as the level at which selection acts. Ted and I, when drawing up the specification for our Arthromorphs program, didn't attempt to simulate hemoglobin-style gene duplication per se. However, our new program did incorporate a form of gene duplication and deletion, which proved to be highly instructive. Whereas all my previous biomorph programs had a fixed repertoire of genes, 9, 16, or 36 for the three versions, Arthromorphs had a variable number of genes, the number of genes itself being subject to mutation. Can you see that we were moving in the direction of letting evolution do its own rewriting of the software, whereas previously, for each macromutated advance in the evolvability of biomorphs, I had had to sit down and write a whole lot more code. Segmentation was deeply woven into the fabric of arthromorph embryology, although it was genetically allowable to have only a single segment. Left-right mirroring was a default constraint. All arthromorphs were left-right symmetrical. Each segment consisted of an oval body part, its shape and size under genetic control, with the capacity to grow a pair of symmetrical limbs, each limb with the capacity to bifurcate in a claw. So far, so arthropodon. The number of joints in each limb was under genetic control, as were the size of each and the angle of each joint, and the same went for the size and angle of the terminal claws. Where it starts to get embryologically more interesting is that groups of neighbouring segments in series share fields of influence. For example, the first three, say, segments might be nearly the same as each other, but more different from the next two segments, and different again from the next four segments, a structure redolent of head, thorax, abdomen. See the E appendix. Each of these, of course it didn't have to be three, that number was itself subject to genetic variation, each of these groups of segments we called a tagma, plural tagmata, which is the correct name in arthropod biology. But the segments within a tagma didn't have to be literally identical. Each segment was influenced by its own tagma-specific genes, which were free to mutate independently of the other segments. The comparative uniformity within a tagma was achieved by multiplying the genetic quantities of each segment by a number, a gene, specific to that tagma. Arthromorph 2 in the picture is similar to arthromorph 1, except that segment 3, though recognisably a member of tagma 1, has longer legs than the other two segments of tagma 1. Tagma 3 as a whole has different legs too. At a higher level, there were other genes which multiplied the value of all the genes of the whole organism across all tagmata. Finally, we added gradient genes, which multiplied the other genetic effects by an increasing or decreasing number as you proceeded posteriorly along the organism or along a tagma. Increases and decreases in numbers of tagmata and of segments within each tagma were achieved by gene duplication or deletion. Such was arthromorph embryology, and you'll notice that it was more complicated than biomorph embryology in biologically interesting ways. It pushed me to the limit of my programming skill so that I had to lean on Ted's superior experience. I did the coding myself in Pascal, which was not Ted's preferred language and has now, as I've already mentioned, been largely superseded. But Ted guided me with emailed suggestions written in a kind of pseudo-computer language pretty much akin to a formal subset of English. At times, I suspect he must have got a little impatient with my slowness, not up to the standards of a professional Apple software engineer, but he was always very kind, and we got it finished in the end. Once the difficult embryology routine was written, it was a simple matter to embed it in a version of the original Biomorph program to handle the choosing for breeding on the screen. The picture appendix shows a zoo, perhaps flea circus is a better term, of a selection of the countless arthromorphs that I was able to breed by artificial selection once the program was finished. Christopher Langton's series of artificial live conferences continued, as did a related series called Digital Biota. Chris himself was present at the second of these, held at Magdalen College, Cambridge in 1996, and I was invited to give the keynote address on the title The View from Real Life, obviously an attempt to ground the geeks in real biology as they explored the enchantments of their virtual worlds. The conference, for me, was chiefly memorable because of a wonderful impromptu speech by Douglas Adams, reprinted in The Salmon of Doubt, and because it was there that I met Steve Grand, author of Creation, Life and How to Make It, a tour de force to match the virtuosity of his artificial life program, Creatures. It was also there that I was introduced to the amazing possibilities of virtual worlds in which avatars, owned by players from all over the world, could roam amid fantastic castles and palaces, casinos and streets, all built and even policed as a communal project. Although I am intrigued by the feats of programming that go into such virtual worlds, I find something a little creepy about the extremes reached by people who, through their avatars, inhabit them. The phrase get a life has become a cliché, but you can't help feeling it ought to be hung up in prominent town squares in Second Life, where the inhabitants have even been known to marry people whom they've never met in the flesh, and subsequently get divorced over unfaithfulness in cyberspace. Ah, well, perhaps it is the way of the future, and one day I shall virtually eat my own real words. After this chapter was written, I was contacted by Alan Cannon, a virtuoso programmer from Kentucky, who volunteered to resuscitate the Arthromorphs program and the other programs of my Watchmaker suite, so that they will run on modern computers. You can download the latest version of Watchmaker suite from an address given in the e-appendix, or Google Watchmaker suite, together with Cannon, C-A-N-O-N. The cooperative gene. My emphasis on the species gene pool, rather than the individual genome, as the text of A Genetic Book of the Dead, also serves to shore up another central plank of my worldview, the cooperative gene. This is the obvious but important idea that, from a functional point of view, the gene is impotent outside the context of the other genes in the gene pool, which is to say the other genes with which it has to share a large number of individual bodies, distributed in space and time. There is a whole chapter, The Selfish Cooperator, devoted to it in Unweaving the Rainbow, but it is an idea that was foreshadowed, despite the book's title, in The Selfish Gene. A gene that cooperates well with most of the other genes that it is likely to meet in successive bodies, i.e. the genes in the whole of the rest of the gene pool, will tend to have an advantage. For example, a number of attributes are desirable in an efficient carnivore's body, among them sharp cutting teeth, the right kind of intestine for digesting meat, and many other things. An efficient herbivore, on the other hand, needs flat grinding teeth and a much longer intestine with a different kind of digestive chemistry. In a herbivore gene pool, any new gene that conferred on its possessors sharp meat-eating teeth would not be very successful. This is not because meat-eating is universally a bad idea, but because you cannot efficiently eat meat unless you also have the right sort of intestine and all the other attributes of a meat-eating way of life. Genes for sharp meat-eating teeth are not inherently bad genes, they are only bad genes in a gene pool that is dominated by genes for herbivorous qualities. This is a subtle, complicated idea. It is complicated because the environment of a gene consists largely of other genes, each of which is itself being selected for its ability to cooperate with its environment of other genes. I would happily bring out a new book called The Cooperative Gene, but the book itself would be identical, word for word, with The Selfish Gene. As it happens, my colleague and former pupil Mark Ridley, whose views on evolution are closely similar to mine, has published a book called The Cooperative Gene. That, at least, is the title of the American edition. The original British edition is called Mendel's Demon. There is no paradox here. The selfish genes that survive do so in their environment. That environment, of course, includes the external environment that we can see, the climate, the predators and parasites, the food supply and so on. But an even more important part of the environment of any gene is the other genes in the gene pool of the species, which means the set of genes with which it is statistically likely to share a body. A gene in isolation can have no phenotypic effects, and the phenotypic effects that it does have depend on the other genes that are present in the body in the short term, the gene pool in the long term. Natural selection, at each locus independently, favours whichever allele cooperates with the other genes with whom it shares a succession of bodies, and that means it cooperates with the alleles at those other loci which cooperate in their turn. Cooperation is the name of the game. The effect is that cartels of mutually cooperating genes build up in gene pools. If a member of one cartel were plucked out and plonked down in another cartel, the result would not be a success. My understanding of this important point was heavily influenced by research of the E.B. Ford School at Oxford. Ford and his colleagues showed by hybridization experiments that complex characteristics of moths break down when genes are exposed to a foreign genetic climate, the foreign genetic climate of another species. This work made a big impression on me in my undergraduate tutorials with Ford's junior colleague Robert Creed. Here's how I put it in Unweaving the Rainbow. I apologise for such long quotations, but I have no better words to express a point which has been many times misunderstood. It is tempting to speak of the whole cheetah, or the whole antelope, as being selected as a unit. Tempting but superficial. Also lazy. It requires some extra thinking work to see what is really going on. Genes that program the development of carnivorous guts flourish in a genetic climate that is already dominated by genes programming carnivorous brains, and vice versa. Genes that program defensive camouflage flourish in a genetic climate that is already dominated by genes programming herbivorous teeth, and vice versa. There are lots and lots of ways of making a living. To mention only a few mammal examples, there is the cheetah way, the impala way, the mole way, the baboon way, the koala way. There is no need to say that one way is better than any other. All of them work. What is bad is to be caught with half your adaptations aimed at one way of life, half aimed at another. This kind of argument is best expressed at the level of the separate genes. At each genetic locus, the gene most likely to be favoured is the one that is compatible with the genetic climate afforded by the others, the one that survives in that climate through repeated generations. Since this applies to each one of the genes that constitute the climate, since every gene is potentially part of the climate of every other, the result is that a species gene pool tends to coalesce into a gang of mutually compatible partners. And that is the very important sense in which genes are simultaneously selfish and cooperative, a cornerstone of what, in my more presumptuous moments, I might call my worldview. It is a much more coherent and penetrating way to think about the evolution of cooperation than limp-wristed hand-waving about selection of the organism as a unit. Universal Darwinism. In 1982, the centenary of Darwin's death was marked by commemorations around the world, perhaps most prominently at Cambridge, where the young Charles read for his undergraduate degree in theology, and where he walked with Henslow and collected beetles. I felt honoured to be invited to speak, and I chose as my title Universal Darwinism. My idea was that natural selection is more than just the driving force of evolution in the life forms that we know on this planet. There is, as far as we know, no other force capable of filling the role of ultimate responsibility for adaptive evolution. Adaptive is a necessary word in that sentence. Random genetic drift is responsible for much, if not most, of evolutionary change at the molecular level. But it cannot be responsible for functional adaptive evolution. Only natural selection, as far as we know and as far as anybody has so far imagined, produces organs that work as if an engineer had designed them. Wings that fly, eyes that see, ears that hear, stings that paralyze. Or so I asserted. My stated implication was that if we ever discover life elsewhere in the universe, it will turn out to be Darwinian life. It will have evolved along some local equivalent of Darwinian principles. My argument was not logically unassailable, but I think it's still strong. It became, indeed, my answer to the question, "What do you believe but cannot prove?" in John Brockman's annual Edge series. It amounted to, "Nobody has ever thought of a viable alternative to natural selection." I have to admit that, when you put it like that, it is vulnerable to disproof the moment somebody actually comes up with an alternative. But scientists are allowed to have hunches, and the burden of my contribution was the strong hunch that no such disproof will ever, could ever, transpire. I made what I think is an unassailable case in principle, not just in fact, against all known alternatives to natural selection, most notably the Lamarckian theory invoking use and disuse and the inheritance of acquired characteristics. Hitherto, biologists had gone along with Ernst Mayr, centenarian founding father of the neo-Darwinian synthesis, who thought that Lamarck's hypothesis was in principle a good one, slain only by what T.H. Huxley would have called an ugly fact. Acquired characteristics are not, in fact, inherited. An implication of Mayr's view was that if there were a planet where acquired characteristics were inherited, evolution on that planet could be Lamarckian and would work just fine. This was what I went out of my way to deny, I think convincingly, and nobody has ever published a refutation. It's a fact that muscles that are much used for a particular purpose grow bigger and become better for that purpose. Lift weights and your muscles enlarge. Walk around with bare feet and the skin of your soles gets tougher. If you run marathons, you become better able to run marathons. Your heart, lungs, leg muscles, and many other things become better for the purpose. So, on our hypothetical planet with Lamarckian evolution, stronger muscles, leathery feet, and trained lungs would be passed on to the next generation. Lamarck thought it was by this principle that improvements evolve. The usual objection is that acquired characteristics are not, as a matter of ugly fact, inherited. My objections were different, principled rather than factual, and threefold. First, even if acquired characteristics were inherited, the principle of use and disuse is too crude and too unfocused to mediate all but a few examples of adaptive evolution. The lens of an eye is not washed clear by photons streaming through it. Muscular enlargement represents a rather rare example of an improvement that can come about by use and disuse. Only natural selection has chisels fine and sharp enough and sufficiently accurately aimed to sculpt the multitude of subtle and often tiny improvements of evolution. The principle of use and disuse is too crude and inept. On the other hand, any genetically mediated improvement, no matter how subtle and no matter how deeply buried inside the cellular chemistry of the organism, is grist to natural selection's fine-grinding mill. Second, only a minority of acquired characteristics are improvements. Yes, muscles grow when you use them, but most parts of the body wear out with repeated use and become smaller, less perfect, often pitted and scarred. It has become almost a cliché that religious circumcision over many generations has signally failed to effect any evolutionary reduction in the foreskin. Lamarckian evolution would have to employ some sort of selection mechanism to sort out the few improvements, like leathery feet, from the many disimprovements, wearing out of hip joints, etc., and that sounds a lot like Darwinian selection. Our bodies are not walking inventories of ancestral scars and broken limbs, notwithstanding popular belief. My mother had a beloved dog called Bunch, who had a habit of limping on three of his four legs. Luxating patella is a common problem in small dogs. A neighbour had an older dog, Ben, who had lost one hind leg in an accident and limped, perforce, on the only three legs left to him. She tried to persuade my mother that Ben must be Bunch's father. Indulge me in a shameless moment of sentiment. Looking this week through a tattered folder of poems that my parents collected for each other over many years, painstakingly copied out by hand, I found the following in my mother's handwriting, obviously written immediately after the death of Bunch. It is unfinished, as can be seen from the crossings out and corrections, but I think it is beautiful enough to be reproduced here. And if you can't be sentimental in an autobiography, when can you? Dear little ghost of happiness who lopes beside me down the years, no dog of flesh and blood will take your place, nor ever stem the tears that come unbidden from the heart. For you were very part of me. And all the fields and all the ways down woodland ride or open hill are empty places now for me. You are not there. You are not there. Dear Bunch, it's all nonsense to say you can't miss a dog as much as a person. Or to put it another way, for purposes of mourning, a dog can become a person. My third objection to any kind of evolution based on the inheritance of acquired characteristics might not necessarily apply universally to all life forms everywhere. It is, however, an objection in the case of any life form whose embryology is epigenetic, as earthly embryology is, rather than preformationistic. And it remains arguable for another day that preformationistic embryology is in principle unworkable. What do these technical terms, epigenetic and preformationist, mean? They go way back in the history of embryology. I would now call them origami embryology and 3D printer embryology, respectively. Origami embryology, as I wrote in The Ancestor's Tale and The Greatest Show on Earth, creates a body by following a recipe or program of instructions to grow tissues and fold them, invaginate them, refold them, turn them inside out. It's of the nature of origami epigenetic embryology that it is irreversible. You can't take a body and reverse engineer the instructions that made it any more than you can take an origami bird or boat and reverse engineer the folding sequence that gave rise to it, or take a gourmet dish and reconstruct the words of its recipe. Preformationist or blueprint embryology is quite different. It is reversible and it doesn't exist in the biology of our planet. This is why it is wrong to describe DNA as a blueprint. Blueprint embryology, if it existed, would be reversible. You can reconstruct the blueprint of a house by measuring its rooms and scaling down. You can't reconstruct the DNA of an animal, no matter how detailed and meticulous your measurements of its body. Preformationist or blueprint embryology is well portrayed by a 3D printer. The 3D printer is a natural extension of the ordinary paper printer. It builds up the object it is printing, layer by layer. I first saw one of these astonishing machines as the guest of Elon Musk in his SpaceX rocket factory. This particular 3D printer was, as an exhibition tour de force, printing chessmen. Unlike a milling machine, which plays the role of a computer-controlled sculptor and subtractively carves objects out of a block of metal, a 3D printer builds the object up additively, layer upon layer. You can present it with serial scans of an existing 3D object in layers, and it will then build up the layers again in the new, copied object. Life, as we know it, develops epigenetically, not preformationistically. Don't, by the way, be confused by the fact that the word epigenetics has recently been hijacked as a label for a fashionable and overhyped idea that changes in gene expression, which of course happen all the time during the course of normal embryonic development, otherwise all the cells of the body would be the same, can be passed on to future generations. Such transgenerational effects may occasionally happen, and it's a quite interesting, if rather rare, phenomenon. But it's a shame that, in the popular press, the word epigenetics is becoming misused as though cross-generational transmission was a part of the very definition of epigenetics, rather than a rare and interesting anomaly. One could just, perhaps, only just, only perhaps, imagine a preformationistic life form somewhere in the universe whose embryology works like a 3D printer, scanning the parent's body and then building the child up layer by layer. And such a life form could, in theory, pass on acquired characteristics to the next generation. Whatever scanning mechanisms copied the present body could copy its acquired alterations, presumably including the scars of injury, mutilation, and wear and tear. But everything we know about the DNA protein-based life of this planet is inimical to the idea of scanning the parental body and rendering the scanned information into the genes for transmission to the next generation. That isn't, nor could it be, how DNA works. You can't reconstruct an animal's genome from its body, and the only way we know to construct a body from its genes is to grow an embryo in a womb or egg. Moreover, to repeat the circumcision point, scanning the body would pick up all the injuries as well as the use and disuse improvements. So, I concluded, Ernst Mayr was wrong to say, accepting his premises, Lamarck's theory was as legitimate a theory of adaptation as that of Darwin. Unfortunately, these premises turned out to be invalid. No, they didn't turn out to be invalid. They couldn't do the job even if they were valid, as a matter of principle. And I hope I gave Francis Crick cause to revise these words. No one has given general theoretical objections why such a mechanism must be less efficient than natural selection. At the end of my talk, Stephen Gould stood up and eloquently demonstrated, not for the first time, the way in which massive erudition can sometimes overload the mind to the extent of obscuring the point that matters. He articulately and fluently pointed out that, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, various alternatives to natural selection were fashionable, mutationism and saltationism, for example. This is historically true, but crashingly beside the point. Like Lamarckism, as I also had argued in my Cambridge lecture, neither mutationism nor saltationism nor any other 19th-century ism is in principle capable of mediating adaptive evolution. Take mutationism, for example. William Bateson, 1861 to 1926, was one of many geneticists, he coined the word, who thought that Mendelian genetics somehow superseded natural selection, and that mutation without selection was a sufficient explanation of evolution. I gave two quotations from him in The Blind Watchmaker. "We go to Darwin for his incomparable collection of facts, but for us he speaks no more with philosophical authority. We read his scheme of evolution as we would those of Lucretius or Lamarck." And again, "The transformation of masses of populations by imperceptible steps guided by selection is, as most of us now see, so inapplicable to the fact that we can only marvel both at the want of penetration displayed by the advocates of such a proposition and at the forensic skill by which it was made to appear acceptable even for a time." What utter nonsense! Gould was certainly right, as a matter of historical fact, that other theories of evolution than those of Darwin and Lamarck were going around in the 19th and early 20th century, and Bateson was one of the perpetrators. My point was not to deny the history, but to show that those other theories, along with Lamarckism, were in principle wrong, always had to be wrong. And that should all have been clear from an armchair, even before evidence disproved them. Darwinian natural selection is not only supported by evidence. Where adaptive, functionally improving evolution is concerned, natural selection is certainly the only theory we know that is in principle capable of doing the job. And the generalization will, or such as my hunch, stretch to theories we don't know. I didn't argue for universal Darwinism very well at the Cambridge conference, badly underestimating the time it would take to develop the theme. And in those days I was less skilled at concealing my discomfort when I made a mistake of that kind. This wasn't the only occasion on which I ran out of time, and I recall the familiar sensation of red overheating and literally sweating with anxiety and panic. During the coffee break, after what I perceived as my failure, I sat on, disconsolately motionless, in the emptying lecture hall. A sweet friend who saw my distress came up behind me and silently kissed the top of my head, with her hands gently resting on my shoulders. The warmth of feminine tendresse is one of the good reasons for staying alive. When I came to reprise the story of universal Darwinism in the last chapter of The Blind Watchmaker, I told it better. Memes. In the last chapter of the original edition of The Selfish Gene, I advocated a version of universal Darwinism in the course of downplaying the gene, which had been the starring hero of the rest of the book. Any self-replicating coded information, I argued, could step into evolution's play as understudy to DNA. And maybe on some distant planet it has. I should have added, but didn't make it sufficiently clear until the extended phenotype, that the understudy would need an additional qualification, the power to influence the probability of its own replication. Indeed, before I had the title of the extended phenotype, I remember that Geoffrey Parker, pioneering evolutionary theorist of Liverpool University, asked me what my next book would be about, and I said, power. Geoff got the point immediately, and I can't think of many other people who would have got it from that single word. In 1976, when introducing the idea of universal Darwinism in The Selfish Gene, what other examples of potentially powerful replicators, hypothetical alternatives to DNA, could I turn to? Computer viruses would have done it. They had only just been invented in some squalid little mind, and even if I'd thought of them, I wouldn't have wanted to advertise the idea. I mentioned the possibility of strange replicators on alien planets and continued, but do we have to go to distant worlds to find other kinds of replicator and other consequent kinds of evolution? I think that a new kind of replicator has recently emerged on this very planet. It is staring us in the face. It is still in its infancy, still drifting clumsily about in its primeval soup, but already it is achieving evolutionary change at a rate that leaves the old gene panting far behind. It is true that cultural evolution is orders of magnitude faster than genetic evolution, but I would have been jumping the gun if I'd implied that natural selection of memes should take all credit for cultural evolution. It might, but that would have been a bolder claim than I set out to make. The evolution of language, for example, clearly owes more to drift, mimetic drift, than to anything resembling selection. I went on to coin the word itself. The new soup is the soup of human culture. We need a name for the new replicator, a noun that conveys the idea of a unit of cultural transmission, or unit of imitation. My meme comes from a suitable Greek root, but I want a monosyllable that sounds a bit like gene. I hope my classicist friends will forgive me if I abbreviate my meme to meme. If it's any consolation, it could alternatively be thought of as being related to memory, or to the French word mème. It should be pronounced to rhyme with cream. Just as genes are selected for their mutual compatibility, so, in principle, might memes be. The large literature on memetics has adopted the word memeplex as a contraction of meme complex. In The Selfish Gene, I reiterated the idea of cooperating gene complexes. I used the phrase evolutionarily stable set of genes, and then tentatively drew the memetic parallel as follows. Mutually suitable teeth, claws, guts, and sense organs evolved in carnivore gene pools, while a different stable set of characteristics emerged from herbivore gene pools. Does anything analogous occur in meme pools? Has the God meme, say, become associated with any other particular memes? And does this association assist the survival of each of the participating memes? Perhaps we could regard an organized church with its architecture, rituals, laws, music, art, and written tradition as a co-adapted stable set of mutually assisting memes. And here's another interesting possibility. If we acknowledge that memes, as well as genes, might be naturally selected, then mutually compatible complexes of memes and genes together might be favoured, each in their respective domains of selection. Thus, if the genetic book of the dead is a description of ancestral environments, why would those ancestral environments of genes not include ancestral memes? Wouldn't ancestral social practices, ancestral religions, ancestral marriage customs and habits of warfare have constituted an important part of the worlds in which ancestral genes survived, and vice versa? In addition to regional differences in climate, exposure to the sun, exposure to cow's milk, etc., there are important differences between populations in culture, religion, traditions, marriage customs, and so on, which could have exerted different selective effects on genes. That's not at all implausible. The populations concerned have been geographically more or less separated for long enough. So the genetic book of the dead might include a description of ancestral cultures. Another way to put that is that genes and memes cooperate with each other in mutually compatible cartels. This is what E.O. Wilson meant when he spoke long ago of gene-culture coevolution. Is there a mimetic book of the dead? And does it include descriptions of ancestral genes as well as memes? I leave that as a field for the reader to plough, adding as a seed the suggestion that cultural, linguistic or religious barriers to gene flow and meme flow could play the same role as geographic barriers in fostering evolutionary divergence. Interestingly, such cultural barriers could work even where geographic distances between populations are too small to do so. If the enmities between neighbouring valleys in the New Guinea Highlands have isolated their warring populations sufficiently to foster the evolution of 1,000 mutually unintelligible languages, what does that do to gene flow between them? If the genetic book of the dead is a description of ancestral worlds, including their cultures, why should there not be a mimetic book of the dead, whose descriptions include ancestral genes? And, mutatis mutandis, why should the genetic book of the dead not include a description of ancestral memes? I've been a little detached from it, but there has grown up a large literature on mimetics, including many books with meme in the title. Significant advances in meme theory have been made by, among others, Susan Blackmore in The Meme Machine, Robert Onger in The Electric Meme, and Daniel Dennett in several books including Consciousness Explained, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, Breaking the Spell, and Intuition Pumps. Both Dennett and Blackmore see mimetics as playing a crucial role in human evolution, including the evolution of mind. Sue Blackmore has convened a series of Meme Lab workshops in the eccentrically beautiful Devon house she shares with her husband, the television science presenter Adam Hart Davis, who incidentally was involved when at Oxford University Press with the publication of The Selfish Gene. Each one organised as a complete weekend house party with the participants sleeping in the house and eating meals together, these workshops capture, for me, some of the wonderfully companionable thinking aloud feeling that I've always found so congenial. If the weather is kind, the workshop ends in a windy climb up a Dartmoor Tor. On one memorable occasion, Dan Dennett was able to be present, and, as he usually does, he raised the game of the rest of us.